ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The best design? You never notice it. The kettle, the beanbag, the umbrella, they look the way they do because someone somewhere made a decision and that decision stuck. What does that say about them? And what does it say about us? The objects all around you have a story. Hear them on By Design with me, Anthony Burke. Search By Design on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land. I'm Tracy Holmes. Spam, that pink jellied meat in a can, has been around since the 1930s. Born in the US, it was a Depression-era staple. Later, it became an oddly fashionable addition to 50s cocktail parties. By the 1970s, though, it was a gag in a famous Monty Python sketch.
Spam, bacon, sausage and spam! Spam, egg, spam, spam, bacon and spam! Spam, spam! Spam, 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 spam.
Plenty of people love to hate spam, but in many parts of the world, it's still going strong. An historian of spam, yes, there is such a person, joins me later. But first, this week, the Pope will be in Barcelona to officially bless the completed final tower of La Sagrada Familia, the monumental Catholic basilica, more than 144 years in the making. The blessing will coincide with the centenary of its architect, Antoni Gaudí's death. Today, against the odds, the exterior of his extraordinary temple is finally complete. New Zealand-born architect Mark Burry AO spent nearly 40 years working on Gaudí's masterpiece, recruited in Barcelona as a wide-eyed 22-year-old student in 1979. These days, Mark is adjunct professor at Swinburne University of Technology's School of Design and Architecture and a senior faculty member at the Institute for Advanced Architecture of Catalonia. And he joins me from Adelaide. Mark, welcome.
Hi, Tracy.
I'm really interested to know how you wound up working on Gaudí's masterpiece back in 1979.
I was a student in England and we were counselled not to take any interest in Gaudí because he was too weird. And being from this part of the world, that was a green light to go and find out more. And I just ended up, I got a scholarship to do a small thesis and interviewed the two 90-year-old architects who were in charge of taking the project forward. And that led to an invitation to join the team.
Incredible. So this is back in the 1970s and into the 80s. You say there wasn't a lot of interest in Gaudí in the architectural establishment at the time. In fact, they were trying to turn people off a focus on him. Why was that?
Well, I was being educated at the end of the modern movement. And if you think most of our cities and think Gaudí, you'll see there's a huge difference between them. So we were being promoted towards the rectilinear and the vertical, not the curvy and sculptural of Gaudí. And my sensibilities lay more with Gaudí than with the modern movement.
And also, it was just a few years after the Franco dictatorship, wasn't it? And that part of the country had become something of a pariah.
Yeah, you'll see that when you look for books on Spanish art and architecture, any time after the 1940 through to the 70s is very little. It was sort of like a non-new topic of interest. I didn't have any of that particular baggage, combination of youth and from where I hailed. And so just went for it.
Yeah, and you went there with an open mind, obviously, but how did you converse with people? How was your Spanish or Catalan?
So the context is that the building was, from my point of view, abandoned. That's what we'd been taught. And when I arrived there, I found that, in fact, it was very much alive and that they'd duplicated the original transept at Gaudí, then the nativity facade, then sort of built a version of it as the passion facade on the other side. But the team was only two 90-year-old architects who had known Gaudi when they were young architects themselves, and for technicians. And I arrived at exactly the time that they were thinking about the main body of the church, the nave. So in terms of communication, I had no Catalan or Spanish, and they had no English. So it was my schoolboy French, and they were a bit more au fait. And I just asked a couple of questions that sort of got their interest, and that's what led to the opportunity of going to work there.
Do you think it was your open-mindedness that made them engage with you in such a way to include you and make you such a part of the process?
The initial invitation, the opportunity to interview them was their open-mindedness. I think they were surprised to have a young Cambridge graduate sort of asking tricky questions. But the questions I asked were, I really was interested in knowing where was the authority to continue such an extraordinary building with the master dead for over 50 years at that point? And even if they felt they knew what he wanted, how did they communicate to the people actually building it what their task was? And that turned out to be exactly the questions that they were embracing themselves. So I don't know how we managed to get that across in my schoolboy French, but it obviously worked.
And how slow was progress at the time?
Well, I'm not allowed to say this, but genuinely, the two directors, they felt the building would be finished in 10 years.
Okay.
And I regard my unbridled optimism, which has carried me forth hence from meeting these two characters. It was very, very slow. I mean, criminally slow.
And they must have been characters to still be so committed to it into their 90s. But let's talk about Gaudi, the man. Who was he and how did he first get the job on this temple?
He's an enigma. He was trained in Barcelona, but he came from a village, from a family. His father was a kettle maker, a sort of an artisan in the south of part of Catalonia. So he was an impoverished student, and it's always a strange, unanswered question. How did someone so young get the carriage of such a important project? But the point is, at the time that he was invited to become the executive architect, it was a project that had already commenced under another architect who resigned after a year. And it was effectively the size of a parish church. So what they thought they were commissioning was a young, impoverished, recently graduated architect to simply undertake the design that had been made by a very well-known architect who had resigned from the project after a year.
So La Sagrada Familia basically translates to the Holy Family. Who was it being built for? What was the purpose of the building?
So the full name is the Expiatory Temple or Church of the Holy Family. Expiatory implies atonement for sins through expiation. So from the get-go, it was a crowdsourced building, a funded building, by a foundation that had been established in the name of Joseph, father of Jesus. And they were worried about the social changes of Barcelona in the mid-1800s due to rapid industrialization and the loss of family values. That's all very familiar with
the
today.
Same things just go round and round, don't they?
They do, it says, yeah. And so they were called the devotees of St. Joseph, and they bought a site and sought funding to build a church in honour of the patriarch, which is Joseph. So that was the foundation of it.
And he turned this more modest project into his grand vision, didn't he? Were there protests at the time? Were there supporters of his that protected him? I mean, he sounds like he was a little bit insane in some ways.
Who knows? He was involved on the project for 43 years. So I think we all have to think about, those of us who are 43 and older, can have to think about what does 43 years feel like. So I think there's an aspect of a slowly boiling frog. in that he was able to introduce ideas. So, for instance, the building was already started when he joined it, but he added a bay to the nave on each side. So that meant instead of being a three-aisled nave, it became a five-aisled. And then obviously he grew it taller. So I think as his fame grew on his secular projects, obviously the committee realised that they'd were more than just a humble executive architect. They had someone with his own brilliance to offer the project. So I think he must have been very persuasive and took the project on. They also got a very large bequest in the 1890s, which sort of oxygenated the project considerably.
Yeah. He suffered an unfortunate and unexpected death in 1926. Had he left any writings or notes behind for people who were going to come after?
No. So one of the great stories of Gaudí is that he never wrote a word about his theory of architecture. But he had all these so-called disciples who faithfully recorded his aphorisms as he went through. So we know pretty well what his theory of architecture was as reported by his disciples. But in the last 12 years of the project, he came to a sticky end with his secular projects. Taste changed. He had a litany of projects that didn't finish very well for him. So he was effectively obliged to put the last 12 years of his time into the Sagrada Familia. And I think that led to a quantum shift in his thinking, because whereas he had practiced more or less as a sculptor of sculptures the size of buildings and didn't quite get away with it because it's just not a practical way to deliver large projects, he then had to sort of do a rethink and recalibrate, and fortunately introduced a very sophisticated use of geometry. So it's like a code. And that geometry was captured in very detailed models, scaled models, which despite their destruction during the Civil War in the 1930s, fragments of them still contained enough information for us to unpack his intentions.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because there's this mathematical side and the artistic side. Since when has art been practical? And yet it's got this mathematical foundation.
No, I think he like the famous definition of architecture in the Oxford English Dictionary is it's the art or science of building. So even the dictionary can't make its mind up. And Gaudí was extraordinary because he was scientific as well as being a consummate artist and a practical man, because his childhood was spent with his father beating flat sheets of copper into kettles. So he knew all about the formation of space at a practical level.
Mm. So he knew what could be done, and then the challenge became convincing others of that. But he seemed to be quite successful at, leading people into his vision. But 10 years after his death, his workshop was then destroyed during the Spanish Civil War, and that really could have been a disaster. Do you think there was a possibility then that the project could have ended? I mean, it almost sounds like there's signs coming from somewhere. People are trying to destroy this project.
This isn't the time to get into the church and society in Spain and what happened during the Civil War. But the project was attacked by anarchists who were obviously anti-church and anti-establishment. The reason the building wasn't demolished was that they realised it was a perfect position for machine guns. Because it was over 100 metres tall, the towers. But they did their best to eradicate the project by attacking Gaudí's workshop, because Gaudí ended up not only working on site but living on site. And if the project was relying on drawings, it would have been the end. But because Gaudí produced undrawable buildings, that's always been my interest in architecture, is the undrawable buildings that are not complicated but complex to the extent that you can't draw them. And he had found a way, using this modelling technique and advanced geometry, to describe the building, and fortunately that could be unpacked even though the models were smashed.
You're listening to ABC Radio National's Late Night Live. I'm Tracy Holmes. We're speaking with Professor Mark Burry AO, adjunct professor at Swinburne, who spent nearly 40 years working on La Sagrada Familia in Barcelona. Mark, now you come into this frame and there's a few small fragments of his plaster models, and you've got to try and make sense of that and expand it to the big vision. That's an enormous task. How did you go about that?
So the link was the two directors who, as I said, had worked with Gaudi when he was young. They then said, well, here are these fragments model. We need to know which surface is where and what are the characteristics of them. And initially none of the skills that I'd been taught at architecture school were of any use at all. But I then put my geographer's hat on because I had done map making at high school. And I realised that what they were asking me to do was make maps of the surviving fragments. And the reason for this is with a map, we can then translate that information to people who are going to, first of all, make the reproduction models to show that we had got our heads around the project, and then translate that information to the people who are making it, which are stonemasons.
And he had some pretty unorthodox methods. Tell me about the time he hoisted a donkey up onto the Nativity facade.
Oh, well, it's very well known that he, in my opinion, he didn't really make the best use of the sculptors that he had to do the figurative sculpture for the building, in that he actually would make full-scale models of people, donkeys, whatever, from casts or various other methods, and then say to them, I want that, which is not really the right way to go about it. I would have said, I would have described in a few words as a prompt and then let the sculptor do what they wanted. However, it's quite literal. There's the very famous figure of a soldier from Herod who's slaughtering the innocents, and he's got his arm raised with a sword and he's holding an innocent about to do the worst. And that soldier has six toes. You can't see it. You have to actually clamber on the project, which I could do in those days when OHS was a little bit, health and safety is a little bit less stringent. But there's the soldier with the six toes. And apparently Matamala, the sculptor, had bought in a subject for the, to model the soldier for Gaudi. But he had six toes. And he said to Gaudi, but I suppose I'll make the model with five toes. And Gaudi said, no, we must record nature and all its vicissitudes. So that soldier ends up with his six toes on both feet.
Was there some significance to the six toes? Had he read about that somewhere or seen someone? Or
My view is other things that he did meant that he was very interested in finding the stopping point, the point of perfection for everything. So with these geometries, he could have overcooked or undercooked, but he always seemed to have this touch with these geometries. I think he wanted to record nature as it is and not pretend it was something else. So in this case, the soldier with the six toes was a freak. I don't know how many people were born with six toes, but it's obviously not that many. And he wanted to record that as kind of like a miracle in a way.
So I'm just thinking about the enormity of what you and other team members did. How much of the basilica was actually built when Gaudi died? So that was 100 years ago. What was actually up, which gave you some sort of, a measurement or a scale that you could imagine the rest?
So if we all think of a typical Gothic revival church, have the main body, which is the nave, and it has the two arms, which are the transepts, and then it has the apse. Quite often they're curved round the behind the altar. He had completed one, almost before he died, one of the transepts. So that's the end of the arm, not the main body, and two-thirds of the wall going round the back of the apse. I'd say that's less than 5% of the completed building.
Gee.
But he made the decision to build the nativity facade first rather than putting stone by stone around the whole perimeter of the building to make sure that there was something vertical and highly conspicuous as evidence of progress and also evidence of what the vision was. But so when I joined it, there were two sets of towers on either side of the transepts, nothing of the main body of the church at all. It was a building site.
And his vision included not just the external, but very much looking at the inside, the interior of it, and particularly how it was going to be lit.
Absolutely. He conceived it as a forest. So you're walking in, the columns of the nave are these tree trunks. And this is what gives it such an extraordinary visual effect, is as your eyes go up and up and up, because it's just so tall. It's actually the tallest religious building in the world now that they've finished the cross at the top. So you can get a sense of just how high it is. As your eyes go up, you see these columns branching out. And so you're in this sort of petrified forest. With the light coming through, just like you would see in a forest glade.
Yeah, it sounds quite stunning. What about the acoustics?
Yes. Reverberation time of over 12 seconds. It wasn't till it was finished that both the problem and the opportunity were discovered. The problem is that it's a mellifluous sound. I mean, it's just fantastic. If you're in there on your own and you can just clap your hand or prick a balloon, as we did when we were doing acoustic tests, you get this fantastic rolling sound. But that doesn't really suit all situations. On the other hand, it gives opportunities to composers to really think what sounds best in the building. Gaudi actually conceived it as a musical instrument. So every one of those towers around the perimeter was to have tubular bells in it. So it was, rather than just having a carillon in one corner of the building, the whole building was going to be this musical instrument.
The way you describe that, so the pricking of the balloon or the clapping of your hands, that's one thing. What about when you heard music played there for the first time?
The first time we heard it properly used was actually at the inauguration in 2010, when the Pope came to... It had been consecrated already because of the crypt downstairs, but it was inaugurated as a basilica. And, you know, the hairs on the back of my neck stand up now, thinking about my hair standing up on the back of my neck then. It was just glorious.
Incredible. So the final tower, the Tower of Jesus Christ, it's now finished. And you said it's the biggest religious building in the world. But can you give us some sort of comparison? So for those that haven't seen it, what can we measure it against, you know, stories and you know, the overall footprint?
It's 172.5 metres tall. So you can divide that by three to get stories. So it's getting on for about 60 stories of a commercial building. It's because of the shape of the building, and it's tall and it isn't tall, if you know what I mean. It's not like a Gothic cathedral with just one, two spires or one spire. It's got lots of towers. So it has at least four towers around it, which are slightly lower, and it's got the Mary Tower over the apse. So I think that's one of the remarkable things about it. It dominates the skyline, certainly, but when you're close to it, it doesn't look to be as big as it is when you go into it. And when you go into it, I'd say 10 times would be the scale. It's 10 times bigger than you think it is from the outside.
Really amazing. And I think, I don't know how you think about this as an expert in architecture, but do buildings have a life? They have a life of the person that has designed it or the team that has designed it. But in this particular construction, you're talking about five or six generations of people. And the lives and the energy of those people that's been invested in this. Do you think there's a sense of that when you enter the building?
Yes. I'm hesitating slightly because obviously being involved in it for 37 years, a lot of those years it wasn't a finished building. And it was a remarkable building site, even more remarkable because the public were allowed to go and visit it while it was being built around them. I think the sensation I have now is, if I'm asked, you know, why do I admire Catalonia and Catalan so much, I answer because how many cities the size of Barcelona have produced a building that transcends generations? Mm-hmm. This is a building that So when you see it and you know the fact that there are many people who worked on it who never saw it finished and could never see it finished because they didn't live, they couldn't, you know, the building was took so long. I think a community that would, first of all, recognise an artist like Gaudí and give him space and something to do and believe in the project so that despite civil wars, economic cycles, changes in taste and culture, the building survived. Every major city could have done a Sagrada Familia, but as far as I know, only Barcelona has pulled it off in the modern era.
So this week's going to be a huge occasion, a blessing from the Pope, 100 years to the day since Gaudí's death. And I know there's still so much not known about him, it's impossible to know, but have you ever imagined being in his mind, stepping into his shoes and imagining what he would be thinking of this moment and of La Sagrada Familia today?
Yes, I'm often asked, you know, do you think Gaudí would accept what you've done? And all I can do is point to various of his aphorisms, which said that he was setting the project up for others to conclude it. So I imagine he would be critical because he's a critical individual, and whatever we've done in his name, because he is the architect, nobody else has claimed to be anything other than working on Gaudí's project. I imagine that he would be critical because we only have to look at the nativity facade and the rest of the building, and all of us have tried to be as rich and as sculptural. But there's something about the original facade that says Gaudí, and that we miss him.
Really beautiful. Great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tracy.
And that is Mark Burry AO, adjunct professor at the University of Swinburne and one of the architects responsible for seeing Gaudí's vision become a reality. Coming up, the incredible and quite impressive story of Spam. What does that word mean to you? An inbox full of junk mail that clutters up your feed? Or a feed of salty tinned pork? Like it or loathe it, for plenty of communities around the world, it has been a kitchen staple. It's a relatively cheap form of protein. The world's Spam supply comes from an American company called Hormel. Hormel's Spam spread across half the globe in World War II. The countries who consume the most Spam are the USA and South Korea. Kelly Spring is a food historian who has written a history of Spam. She co-presents a podcast called The Hungry Historians. Kelly joins us from Washington. Hi, Kelly.
Hi there. Nice to meet you.
Yes, you too. Now, we've got to start with demystifying these two types of Spam, email or a pork product. They are, in fact, linked, aren't they?
In some sense, yes. So Spam, the pork product, came first in 1937. And Spam, the email, like junk email, came much later with the, you know, internet and email. And they're linked in the sense that Monty Python did a skit. This is a British post-war like comedy sketch on TV. And the troupe did a skit about Spam, the food, and they were in a sort of greasy diner in Bromley in London, and you see sort of a man and a woman sort of come into the diner, and basically the whole menu is about Spam, and it's like repetition of Spam, and the wife hates Spam, and the man loves it, and he wants extra helpings, and strangely in the corner you see this sort of group of Vikings who occasionally will break out into kind of a chant or a song of Spam, Spam, wonderful Spam, lovely Spam. So that kind of repetition kind of got that going, and so that's where that idea of like repetition and junk connects to sort of our junk mail that we think of today.
Well, we can in fact have a little listen of that Monty Python crew in their cafe.
Excellent. Morning.
Morning.
What you got then?
Well, there's egg and bacon, egg, sausage and bacon, egg and Spam, egg, bacon and Spam, egg, bacon, sausage and Spam, Spam, bacon, sausage and Spam, Spam, egg, spam, spam, bacon and spam. Spam, 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 egg and spam. Spam, 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 baked beans, spam, spam, spam and spam. Oh, lobster thermidor, crevettes with mayonnaise sauce, garnished with truffle pate brandy and a fried egg on top and spam.
Okay, so that was 1970. And Kelly, yes, it's not hard to see how we get from surplus offerings of the food spam to surplus emails. But why did the Hormel company call the canned pork spam in the first place?
I know, this is really interesting. If you look online, you know, there are various people's variations of what they think it is. People think it might be a combination of like spiced ham or specially processed American meat. But actually, there's no answer to this. So Hormel sort of created, when the food came out, before it came out in 1936, they had a competition to name it. And I think it was the brother of their vice president won the competition, and he named it Spam. So it was a bit of nepotism from the start. But actually, Hormel never reveals this detail. They're very tight-lipped, and so you can't find the information anywhere. So I tried to find out this detail, and it's not possible. So don't believe the rumors that you read online. It's not. People come up with some really excellent variations, and I invite the audience to try their hand at it. But yeah, there's no answer to that question.
Yeah, well, a couple that I saw were spiced pork and ham and specially processed American meat. I mean, both are worthy, but, you know, that's not the reason, as you say. What about some of the other misconceptions about spam, like the idea that it's ultra-processed?
Yeah, I think this is really interesting. Spam gets a bad rap, you know, not at first, but like after post-war period, I think probably from the 1960s when there's a bit more affluence in American society and elsewhere, spam kind of gets a bad rap that it's sort of full of chemicals and full of like terrible bits of pig that nobody else will want to eat and they can't produce anywhere else. But actually, it's not an ultra-processed food. So ultra-processed foods don't come into common foods, particularly American food systems, until later in the 20th century. So Spam was made well before that. And interestingly, if you look at the ingredients for the original can of Spam, there's only 6 ingredients. And all of them, except for one, which is sodium nitrite, you can buy easily in the grocery store or you can find it in the pantry. So it's very easy, in a sense, to replicate the recipe at home because it's not the sort of ultra processed. So it gets a bad rap for being like terrible and, you know, bad for you. And of course, you know, it's a meat and it's fatty, so you're not going to eat it all the time, but it's not as bad as it's made out to be in the media.
Yeah. So as you say, you know, ultra processing didn't come in until much later, but has the company essentially stuck with the same format since its beginning?
Essentially. So the original formula is almost the same, except for now they add potato starch. And that's to help the meat congeal better. So essentially, the meat is kind of ground up and it's added sugar and salt and a little bit of seasoning. It's put in the can after it's ground up, and then it's cooked in the can when it's sealed and cooked in the can. And so originally, when they made it, there'd be a kind of separation when it was cooked. So there'd be a kind of gelatin or fatty bit that would separate out from the meat. And so when you open it, you get this like layer of fat, which is useful for, you know, if you're in wartime, for example, and you need a bit of fat for cooking and you don't have it because you're on rations, but it's not very attractive. So in the post-war period, at some point, they put in potato starch and that helps the meat congeal together. And so that's sort of the only change to the original recipe. However, there are at least 15 kinds of Spam now. So there's 15 kinds of, and they have all different recipes. Some are, for example, turkey Spam. Some are Korean barbecue Spam. And so those have new ingredients that were not original to that first recipe.
And was this idea that they first used, was it a technological innovation for the 1930s?
In a sense, yeah. I mean, during the sort of turn of the 20th century, you get companies like Heinz and Campbell's Soup kind of trying to make canned goods. And so that became a really popular way to industrialize the food system, both in the United States and elsewhere. And so Hormel really wants to get into that as well. So they started the company in 1891. But at this point, they want to get into like the canned market because that's where all the money is. And so they start to make these different canned products. So its first canned product is a whole canned ham, which you can actually still buy and they were the first company in the world to actually make that. But then they proceeded to make other canned goods, which were very useful. Particularly, many of the canned goods came out in the 1930s when America's in the height of the Great Depression. And these things are inexpensive to feed families who are, you know, underemployed or unemployed and don't have much money. And so in that way, they are revolutionary for their time.
Yeah, and I guess there's a couple of things there. You know, people might have got their meat from the butcher shop. Maybe that became too expensive during the Depression. Yeah. Butcher shops were closing down. I don't know. I'm imagining this, but it was designed for the Depression, and I wonder how much thought there was about having a life beyond that.
I think, you know, because they're business people, they really wanted to have a product that was good for now, but also that they could keep in their line of products and expand on. So originally the product came about because the company essentially had this kind of pork shoulder left from its other processing. So they had pork shoulder, which they couldn't use elsewhere. Pork shoulder is kind of a tough meat. It was sort of low value. And they wanted to do something with this product. Otherwise, it would go to waste. And of course, that would lower their bottom line, you know, because of this waste. So they decided they could grind it up and add these different ingredients and make this product. So it was part to address the need in the nation, but also part to address their business need. And so that kind of waste would still go on because they've got all these different products. And so they needed to do something with it long term. So I think it's it wasn't necessarily only for that time period.
And then, of course, along came World War II and the international rollout of Spam, really as an exercise in aid.
Yes, certainly. And I think World War II, many people think World War II was when Spam started. It wasn't, but it was really the making of Spam. And as you said, it's about aid. So America didn't join the war until after the bombing of Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. But at the same time, they're still trying to figure out ways to help through different aid programs, particularly to Britain, as well as the British Empire, the British Commonwealth. And so one of the things that they rolled out in the spring of 1941 as Congress passed it and Roosevelt signed it was the Lend-Lease Act. And so this gave essentially unlimited aid in terms of food, military hardware, medical supplies, to the different allies. And so Spam becomes part of that aid, as well as many other food goods from all different American companies. So that's how it starts to travel the world to the allies as aid.
And so who got most of America's Spam during that time?
Yeah, this is really interesting. I mean, Britain is essentially alone in the war, fighting the war, as many of the other allies had been occupied by the Nazis, as well as the sort of Japanese that's happening. And so much of the war of the aid goes to Britain, British Empire, and the British Commonwealth. So the bulk of it really goes to them. And so they get all this food and they get all this Spam, and then Spam becomes part of sort of the everyday experience of, particularly on the British home front. It becomes part of British rationing, which is really important to sustain the British because they had really reduced amounts of meat and protein. And so it was really, really helpful and helped, I think, fill that gap and help them proceed with the war effort.
And is it true that in the UK today you can get Spam fritters in the fish and chip shops?
Yes, you can. Yeah, you can still get them. You know, it depends on where you go. Sometimes it's popular, sometimes it's not. You can also buy them in the freezer section. If you go to any regular grocery store, such as Sainsbury's, Tesco, you go to the freezer section, you can buy these sort of Spam fritters, which are essentially Spam, which are breaded, and then you fry them or you maybe bake them at home. They also have cheese Spam fritters if you want that in the freezer section. So yeah, it's still there. You can still buy it, but Spam is not really that popular in Britain as it, you know, as it was during the war, as it was necessary during the war.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm Tracy Holmes, speaking with Kelly Spring, the author of Spam, A Global History. How did you get so fascinated by this product?
So, you know, I was introduced to it as a child. We used to go camping and my parents thought they would try out Spam. So just like frying it over an open campfire and eating it. But I didn't like it at that point. So that's really remarkable. Like, I didn't want anything to do with it. But my focus, my PhD, my research in food history is related to World War II, and particularly the British home front. And so when I was doing my PhD, I could see mentions of Spam, but I didn't really have time to cover it. I also lived in Korea before, and so I could see it in Korea. And then during the pandemic is really when I had this chunk of time to like sit at home and to entertain myself, I would just look at like British Library, old newspapers from World War II and look for spam. And so it was sort of like I stumbled into it by accident, I guess, or I had a lot of time on my hands. That's what, you know, historians do when they have time on their hands, they do more research. So that's how I got into it.
So Kelly, your kind of reasoning there for having delved into this product, it sounds a little bit like the Monty Python sketch itself, like spam, 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 spam. It just keeps reinserting itself into your life and all of these different moments within it. But you mentioned Korea there. So spam has gone from World War II and dominating the UK, and mm-hmm. it marches into Asia and the Pacific. Tell us mm-hmm. about that period.
So in World War II, you know, spam basically went everywhere the American soldiers went. So if you sort of trace where they were in World War II, you can see that there's probably some remnant or some explosion of spam in that area at that point and onwards. And so as the Americans are in the Pacific theater, you know, they're moving towards the Japanese home islands as they're doing so. They're liberating different islands. So, for example, they occupy Guam, you know, the Philippines, and so on. And so, as they're sort of coming ashore, they're realizing that people are starving in these areas and they need to be fed something that is easy to provide to them. I mean, spam, because it's already cooked in the can, you don't actually need to cook it if you don't have cooking facilities. So, you know, if you're in a decimated war area and you don't have cooking facilities, you can still eat it. So it's a great source of protein in a conflict and war zone. And so the servicemen would give these to these sort of starving populations that they would find. And spam would make the difference between food insecurity or starving and, like, you know, living and surviving. And so that was really important. And so today, when you go to places like the Philippines or Guam, there's huge amount of popularity of spam, and you can find it in everybody's sort of pantry, as it were.
Mm, what about Hawaii? Because that enters the picture as a big consumer. And I guess what we're seeing here is also populations that really have pork as quite an essential ingredient in their cuisine.
Yes, indeed. So Hawaii is a really great example. I mean, if you look at the consumption of spam throughout the United States, Hawaii is the top consumer. And this, again, has to do with the war. So Hawaii was already a sort of naval base at the time. But after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, it really expanded. And there's huge military construction and huge number of men and women coming in to join the war effort. And so because of that, you've got this huge influence of spam coming in with the service members that's being fed to them in the mess hall and so on. And so this becomes sort of attached and to the Hawaiian population as well. So they're exposed to that, you know, it's being flown in. And it's in some ways the Americans have to take over a lot of the Hawaiian traditional agriculture. And so they need to import foods, and then people are eating that more than they're eating traditional foods. So it changes the food ways in a way. You also have the post-war period where you've got a lot of Asians coming into Hawaii, and they're bringing that love of spam too. So you've got a kind of war and post-war combination going on there. And so it really thrives in Hawaii. When I was there a couple of years ago, I was amazed to see you could go to like Burger King or McDonald's and there'd be like, you know, spam with rice and eggs. And it was so common. It was amazing. You don't see that in the mainland of the United States, not nearly like that.
And I think it's interesting to look at some of the other links as well, things that you might not consider without delving into it the way you have. But because of ongoing military exercises and preparations, the military had put limits on fishing activities. So again, that kind of changes the diet.
Yes, indeed. So, you know, in a lot of these places, so Guam, Hawaii and elsewhere, in addition to agriculture, they would have a lot of fish because they're islands. But because the U.S. military was using the waters around the islands, they were also putting, you know, sort of bombs in the water so that, mines in the water. And so to protect the islands. And so people often were banned from going out and fishing like they traditionally would have. And so, again, as you said, that changes the diet. And so they had to rely more and more on these imported goods or these American processed goods. And you see that sort of coming through today, where you see diets that are very different from what they were before the war because of these changes that went on.
Take us to Korea because, you know, South Korea, in fact. I don't know if they if they have spam in North Korea, do they?
I don't think so. I wasn't allowed to go to North Korea. I would have loved to know that, but I'm pretty sure they do not.
I've got a North Korean friend. I'm going to ask him just to know.
I'll let you know. I would love to know that. Maybe they have some knock-on version. You know, it's possible.
That's possible, yeah. But take us to South Korea because, you know, it moves into a different phase again, doesn't it? So it's not just, you know, fending off starvation in periods of war. It kind of moves into, you know, really classic cuisine and becomes a very popular part of it.
Yeah, this is really fascinating. I think, you know, this is the first time after my childhood of not wanting to eat spam where I saw it in a totally different light and that spam was thought very differently. So in Korea, it starts kind of in the same way it starts in Europe. So in the Korean War from 1950 to 1953, the American service members arrive again and again they bring spam with them. So you can see it in the American mess halls. And so on. And Americans will carry it with them as gifts during the war to give to the Koreans, but they also use it as leverage. So Koreans at this time are starving. The agriculture is kind of in a shambles because the fighting has gone back and forth up and down the peninsula, and so there's no possibility to have a growing season. There's no organized rationing because the government is very new. It's just come out of a long period of Japanese colonization before and during World War II. And so the Americans are using this sort of Korean hunger because there isn't much there to eat and giving them spam and trading for information about the enemy. And so there's a kind of, it's almost used as a weapon of war in some senses. And so that's really interesting. So it makes a difference between sort of starving and poverty of wartime and having enough to feed yourself. But it has that kind of tinge to it. But it's really interesting because after the war, you know, there's a period for about 34 years when the Koreans can't get spam. So you can buy it in American service areas, you know, the PX on the bases, but Koreans can't get it. However, spam is being sold illegally on the black market. So it's being sort of smuggled off the base and sold. And so spam goes from being the sort of war-torn sort of poverty food or, you know, food for to sustain yourself to a kind of very high value food. So only really wealthy people can buy spam on the Korean black market, which is amazing. It changes the value completely. In a sense, I think this kind of sets the stage for what happens next. So by 1986, so Korea is having its sort of Winter Olympics. Korea is kind of coming out of its economic depression because of the war. And then the Korean company CJ Cheledong decides that they want a license with the Hormel Corporation to make spam in Korea. So locally made spam, which is generally about the same kind of recipe, but slightly less salty, slightly less fatty to fit the Korean diet. And from then on, it starts to be produced in 1987. From then on, it sort of soars in sales. It becomes hugely popular. So there's about, I think, 500 tons sold the first year and 1,000 tons sold the next year, and just goes on and on and on. So really, really popular, takes off in a way that you wouldn't see it being that popular in the United States.
And it's also become part of a traditional gift-giving enterprise, hasn't it? Especially during national holidays.
Yeah, so this is where I first encountered it, and I was so amazed. So there's two traditional national holidays, which are Chuseok, which is kind of the sort of autumnal festival, which can be August or September usually, and then Solal, which is kind of the New Year celebration. And these are sort of big, huge national festivals. And during this time, people will go out to different stores and they can buy either like a can of spam, or often they'll buy gift sets of spam, which are a couple cans of spam, and then often sort of fancy oils. So these gift sets can range from $20 to $100. They can get quite fancy. And this is given to friends, to family, to work colleagues, and it's kind of an expected and important gift, which is really interesting. So when I was there in the early 2000s, that's when this kind of tradition started with the company, and then it's really taken off. So at this point, it's really popular in Korea, and it about 60% of total spam sales happen during these two holidays. So it really shows you the really important way it's been taken into Korean food days and become almost part of the national celebration.
We haven't spoken about Japan yet, but if you think about, you know, the progress and the movement of the American military, it's probably no surprise that it ended up there too and is now incorporated in some of their meals.
Yeah, so it's people in all over Japan eat it, but it's really particularly popular and most eaten in Okinawa. So again, as you said, you know, the course of the war, the Americans took Okinawa first before they were considering going to the home islands. And so that was really important. And so they encountered the Japanese people and then they, you know, fed them again with Spam. Okinawa also was and still is the site of a big American base. And so there's that long history going on. So if you go to Okinawa, you can go to different, I think, fast food chains and you can buy all different Spam things. So it's quite common there. You can also find it in some, particularly Okinawan traditional dishes. They'll put Spam in instead of pork or some other kind of protein.
You have all of these recipes in your book, a whole lot.
Yeah.
tell us about Spam Salog in the Philippines and Spam Musubi in Hawaii.
Okay, so Spam Salog is, it's a kind of, it's a traditional Filipino dish, which they've taken instead of pork, they put Spam in there instead. So it's essentially like a kind of fried rice and egg and some kind of protein like pork or Spam that's sort of cooked up. I think it's often eaten for breakfast. And it's a very simple dish to make, but it's a very traditional dish. And so it's very common because Spam is very popular in the Philippines, too. Philippines also have a license with Hormel to make Spam there, too. And so it's really, really popular in the Philippines, very common. So, yes, you can find that in the recipes in the back of the book. And also you asked about musubi. That's really great, too. That kind of shows a combination of, I think, Japanese and Hawaiian ingenuity with Spam. So it's a bit like if you think of sushi rolled up. So essentially, you've got bits of Spam, you know, cooked rice or sticky rice, seaweed, and there's a little bit of like sort of teriyaki sauce or some kind of soy sauce that you put over it, and then you roll it up and you eat it, and it's kind of sort of cylindrical in shape. And it's really delicious too, and that's extremely popular, very tasty. I had it when I was there. Highly recommend it if you ever get the chance to have it.
I'm laughing because you got into this because you hated the taste of it when you were a kid. Yeah. And now you're telling me that it's really delicious when it's mixed with all these other herbs and spices.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, so your research does a lot to the palate, I would say, especially for a food historian.
So if you were to describe Spam's legacy, what would you say?
Wow. I think it depends on where you are in the world. And this has to do with how people encountered it, I think, first, how they encountered it in war, but also how it sort of has continued on in that country. So first, I could say, I think wherever Spam was there, you know, if it was there in the war, it's still probably there now in some form. If, for example, you look at the US and the UK, it's not really popular. You can buy it, but it's not really popular. It's kind of thought of as sort of a poor quality. And, you know, it has this sort of negative connotation. It's often thought of as sort of, if you're low income, you buy this sort of thing. It has this negative, idea. But if you go to Asia, as we're talking about in Korea, in the Philippines, in Guam, it's hugely popular. It has a long legacy that's been expanded and then incorporated into the dishes there. And so it really just depends on, I guess, your perspective, both in eating and your sort of life experience. And then also, I think, how it's been passed down the generation. So in Asian countries, you know, it's almost like intergenerational sharing, and often food is that way. And so it's sort of become ingrained in those societies because of that.
I had no idea there was so much to the Spam story. So thanks for informing us, Kelly.
Oh, certainly. Thank you so much for having me. It was wonderful.
Kelly Spring's book is Spam, A Global History. It's published by Reaction through New South here in Australia. And that is the show. On our next, Ian Dunt with his take on British politics. And we'll look to Switzerland, where citizens are about to vote in an unprecedented referendum to essentially cap the nation's population at 10 million. Catch you then.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.